want to welcome you to Dr. Siebert's second or third session.
Second session
this week. In the Beginning, God, Part 2, Scientific Approaches to Evolutionary Biology. Dr. Siebert is Emeritus Professor of Pathology at the School of Medicine at the UW here, this UW versus Wisconsin. Part of his graduate training and scientific research has been in the fields of evolutionary biology and physical anthropology. And as a lifelong Christian, he has a deep interest in the interplay of religion and evolution. So thank you so much for what you're contributing here this week, and we appreciate your presence here. And
thank
he
you.
Had heard a few minutes ago that there was some tapping of a hammer, so I'm going to go look to see where that hammer is, to see if I can stop it from tapping. So
good. Thank you so much. And shall we close that door then? And
yeah.
Just okay. So I see familiar faces, and did we have an assignment?
Hi, I'm Grant.
And you don't remember me, so it's totally unfair.
Okay.
But 30 years ago, we shared a ski chalet in Aspen.
Seriously.
With Dave and Laurel Krieger.
Oh my goodness, and you remember that?
No, but Linda does, and my wife Linda is right there.
Oh, well, isn't that Grant, amazing?
So Grant and his wife Ruth, and we...
We just saw the Kriegers Tuesday night.
Well, good. The last time we saw them, they were alive and well, too, so... Aspen, Colorado. This was a few years ago, which proves my point that evolution does take place. Right? We both looked a little bit different 30 years ago.
I think so.
Right? So welcome. Do we have newcomers here today who were not here a couple of days ago? Okay. So we'll have a few little review slides, okay, to show you what we talked about Tuesday. And we also had an assignment, right, to think about God's creation with our eyes open here in Holden Village, and also with our eyes closed. Any insights or any experiences with God's creation in the last 2 days?
Be grateful for the beauty around here. Every time you look up, there's a mountain or something.
Isn't that true? It's just, yeah, it's just a glorious setting, isn't it? Sure, sure. We're birders, so we've been watching birds and saw a little mama feeding her young this morning. So we've had a good couple of days.
Well, the resilience of the creation after the fire, that's just pretty impressive.
It is something, isn't it? Yeah, the fireweed, that gorgeous, gorgeous flower, that purple flower is out there, isn't it? And I think the woodpeckers are going to come in and work on the insects. And so, yeah, over the next, what would you say, 10 years, 20 years, of course, or more, why this area will continue to change, won't it? Some of us took the evolution walk with Travis, the village naturalist this morning, and he just did a marvelous job talking about different aspects of evolution and how things will change here in the valley after the fire. And you know, the Forest Service has some research plots set up, and they're going to be studying that very carefully and very systematically as well. So it'll be interesting to see what they learn. So we talked about...
No, I have one more thing too. I sort of listened. I opened up my ears, and I've been struck by the presence of water around here, because I grew up on the other side, and so I've always had lakes and Puget Sound close by, but to hear the rushing waters here is a different sound, and it certainly is God's presence for me up here this way.
Isn't it though? Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Oh, so as Lynette was saying, I spent time in pathology. My whole career really was in pathology, as a graduate student, and here I am on the right, as a graduate student, I did some work in evolutionary biology. So Linda and I were cave people, but I guess mostly at Halloween. So that's my background. And so really, I have studied evolution, been a participant in the scientific world, but also have a lifelong Christian faith. And so we bring all of that to bear today. Okay, so we made the main points 2 days ago. God is creator, right? We lift this up in our creeds, Apostles' Creed, Nicene Creed, the sacraments, and Langdon Gilkey, a theologian, said this idea of God as creator is really central to our Christian confidence. We We also made the point that the Genesis story can be seen as a myth. It tells us greater truths, but not necessarily in all of the details. Okay, and God's creation really is ongoing. The theologian John Hout made this comment: what evolution is really about, then, is the world's being invited toward even greater diversity, freedom, and creativity in the presence of the humility of divine love. So the Holy Spirit creates, right? And this is an exciting thing for us. We said evolution is a fact. It's the mechanisms of evolution that are theoretical. The major churches agree on this: the ELCA, the United Methodist Church, Roman Catholic. And I showed you statements from all of those church bodies. I also made the point that we talked just briefly about creationism or intelligent design and said, you know, intelligent design is not intelligent. Okay? Do we ever have neck pain, back pain, knee pain? Right? So we have these wondrous human bodies that in some ways are fragile, aren't they? So if we really look for signs of intelligent design, we don't find it. I mean, people say, well, the eyeball is so complex that it had to be designed by a designer. But really, you can follow the visual apparatus through all sorts of creatures, beginning with the earthworm, and you can understand how the eye can develop over time. The intelligent design people, I think, see God as a magician, right? And really a bumbling magician, right? There were dinosaurs for millions of years, and then no dinosaurs. Right, Australopithecus for millions of years, then Homo habilis, then Homo erectus. And so this is sort of a capricious God, or a God who can't figure things out, right, if these things are changing all the time, right? If we see these events as naturally occurring events in a biological context, I think it really makes more sense. And it's, I think, more respectful of God. Okay, but here's God as a kid who tries to make a chicken in his room. Just a hilarious cartoon and what you'd expect from Gary Larson. But I am going to say a couple more words about intelligent design, because I think it's a serious problem worthy of combating. So here's a quote from a creationist website about the appendix, the human appendix. It had a created function in people originally, but as a result of the curse, consequent upon Adam's sin on all creation, humanity has degenerated. Thus, our body has lost some functions which it once had. Okay, so we've got an appendix because of Adam's sin in the Garden of Eden, and of course we can debate Adam. Does the translation really mean Adam and humanity, right? This is not a very good explanation for the presence of the appendix, right? Did Adam's sin have something to do with the opossum or the kangaroo or the koala, the zebra, the rabbit, right? Lots and lots of mammals have an appendix, right? And I think it does not have to do anything, have anything to do with this idea of Adam in the Garden of Eden. We all know this anyway. The major importance of the appendix would appear to be the financial support of the surgical profession. Okay. This is an anatomy textbook which makes this little statement. I never saw humor in an anatomy textbook, but there it is. Okay, so that's the vermiform appendix. The ELCA has a statement on evolution. The ELCA does not have an official position on creation versus evolution, but we subscribe to the historical critical method of biblical interpretation, this idea that the Bible must be understood in the historical context of the times. So we believe God created the universe, but not necessarily in 6 24-hour days, and may have actually used evolution in the process of creation. Okay, so this was an important point we made 2 days ago, that the Bible is not a scientific textbook, right? And I think it should not be used as a scientific textbook. Okay, and this is why Lutheran pyramids should be planted, right? That, it's been said over and over that Lutherans make very, very gentle statements. That I think is one of them. Science is supported by religion. Religion supports the adventure of scientific discovery in positive ways. So there's no reason for science and religion to bump heads. They do bump heads sometimes, but I think it's not warranted, right? Science and religion ask different questions. They use different methods of trying to answer those questions, or at least grapple with those questions. So that's what we talked about on Tuesday. Today we're going to talk about the scientific discoveries of evolution. Realize we can only skim the surface, right? There is an enormous literature about evolution. And there are journals devoted to the study of evolution. There really are. And we, of course, we can't get into detail, but we will talk about some generalities, okay? Evolution is a fact. It can be observed. It can be studied. The mechanisms are theoretical, but they can be tested. And tests when they are done by a wide variety of scientific disciplines, okay? Chemistry, physics, mathematics, whatever. Okay, the same science that makes the 737 fly, the same science that makes your automobile work, that same science is used to study evolution. Evolution is ongoing. If you follow the media, you will see from time to time descriptions of new things, and I'll show you some examples today. But this does not need to be threatening to us as people of faith. But people of faith may know very little about the science of evolution, right? This does not stop us from having opinions, right? We have opinions even though maybe we know very little about evolution. The converse can be said. A lot of scientists know nothing about religion. That doesn't stop us either from having our opinions, right? So in this area of evolution, people are spouting opinions continually, and many just know nothing about the topic, right? Remember Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan? Everyone is entitled to their own opinion. They're just not entitled to their own facts. Okay? We might just have that engraved on a stone somewhere in Washington, D.C. I don't know, but it's just a thought. H.L. Mencken said this: even a superstitious man has certain inalienable rights. He has a right to harbor and indulge his imbecilities as long as he pleases, provided only that he does not try to inflict them upon other men by force. So we can have opinions, and certainly scientists have opinions, people of faith have opinions. These may not necessarily be facts. I made the point 2 days ago when we're talking about the science of evolution, you don't have to know what scientists know, but it's helpful to know how they think. So what I'll do today is really try to show you how scientists think about the question of evolution, how they work on topics from different disciplines. Okay, so it's helpful to know how scientists think. I might use a few technical terms today. Okay, here's some of the cave people at the spelling bee, right? Cave, C-A-V-E. We'll use the word Australopithecus, okay? Yeah. But we are going to talk some about theory, some about hypotheses, right? And I should think we know this, that a hypothesis is really a statement, usually a positive statement about something, and then you test that hypothesis to see if it's true or not. And a theory is really a generalized framework that somehow deals with a body of facts. Okay, so I just want to give you one example. All right, in our youth room a few months ago, we came in one day and the floor was very wet, okay, and the walls were very wet. Now that was a fact, okay, and we developed a theory about that, right? We have a water leak somewhere. And we developed a hypothesis. The narthex kitchen plumbing is leaking, and somehow this drains downstairs to the youth room. So you see, we've got this, we've got some observations, we've got a generalized way of thinking about it, a water leak, then we make a statement. We have a water leak. Now we're going to test that hypothesis, right? Go upstairs to the narthex, turn on the water, and see what happens, right? And so that's how we worked through this issue of a leak in our room. This is how science works, right? It can make observations, try to understand or describe what happens to explain those observations. And this happens all the time in evolutionary biology. I think some people don't understand that because they think scientists are confused and staggering around, which of course they could be. But think of it as a detective who goes to a crime scene, right? Makes some observations, right? Those are facts, those are observations, and then you try to explain those observations. And this is elementary to science, right? Developing theories, developing hypotheses, testing them. This is how science works, okay? But theorizing can be confusing, so I think if you see things in the media, ask yourself, is this an article that deals about science? Does it deal about religion? Are we talking about facts, or are we talking about opinions? Right? And importantly, are we using science to explain religion, or are we using religion to explain science? And I think both would be faulty, wouldn't we? Is God named? Okay, the people who support intelligent design will, many times if they're questioned, they will say, no, I'm not talking about God. It's something else. It could be anything else, an intelligent designer. Because if you say God, then the courts will say, well, it's you're talking about religion, you're not talking about science, right? So the intelligent designers, I think they're thinking about God, but they probably won't say so. But really, if intelligent design were there, what would it be? It'd have to be either God or a Martian, wouldn't it? What I don't know what other designers would be there. So watch for all of this in the media. Okay. So we're going to talk about how evolution does take place. Okay. So lots of mechanisms for evolution. You know, we talk about survival of the fittest and Charles Darwin and all that, but really there are lots of mechanisms of evolution, and they act at different times, could conceivably act in concert in a given situation. Natural selection is sometimes called gradualism or Darwinian gradualism or Darwinian selection. It's really this idea of survival of the fittest. And we've thought about that a whole lot, don't we? We can come up with examples. Travis talked about survival of the fittest today, that certain adaptations are useful in a given environmental situation. Gene flow or gene drift over time. You know, we're learning more and more about genetics all the time, which informs our understanding of evolution tremendously. But genes will vary in different samples of a population, right? I mean, I think maybe you could say years ago, why are there so many blondes in Ballard? Okay, I have no idea. Ballard writes a part of Seattle. Are there a lot of blondes in Seattle? Well, a lot of Scandinavian fishermen, right, settled in Ballard, right, because this was a good fishing area. I have no idea if there are more blondes in Ballard or not, but this would be an example of how a gene pool could be accentuated in one area and not another area. Maybe, you know, right, more redheads in Ireland, that sort of thing. And that leads us to reproductive isolation, where if, let's just say, you're shipwrecked on an island in the South Pacific, right, and this happened, right, the mutiny on the Bounty, a few mutinous sailors were put ashore on those islands, and then they destroyed the ship. And so the gene pool changed on that island. Those sailors, over time, married some of the Polynesian women, and so all of a sudden they changed the genetics of that South Sea island. Okay, and so this can happen. Australia, well, a lot of islands, right? Madagascar, Australia, have some pretty unique life forms. Well, it's because those creatures are stuck on an island, right? And so, Tasmania, and we will speak about Tasmania in just a couple minutes, right? Adaptive radiation, Travis got at that a little bit today. This idea that there are habitats, right? The world is full of different habitats, and not only habitats, but niches within habitats. So let's just say the forest is a habitat, but in the forest, we know there's the forest floor, there's the understory, right? There's the canopy, and different animals live in different parts of the forest, for example, right? Some monkeys live in the treetops. I think a few years ago, some new species was discovered in South America. This is a monkey living up in the treetops, but in the rainforest, this monkey never came down to the ground, and so the scientists didn't even know that there was a new species up there in the canopy. Okay, adaptive radiation. So if a niche becomes goes what? Well, either animals can move into a niche that wasn't there, or some creature goes extinct in a niche and then another animal moves into that niche or radiates into it. And I think of this, in the 1940s, it would have been really, really smart to buy internet stocks. Would that have been a good move in the 1940s? Except there was no internet, right? So that niche was empty, okay? And in the 1940s, I mean, there were some computers, right? But I don't think anybody dreamed of what the computing world would look like in 2015, 16, 17. So that was a niche, but it was an empty niche. And then all of a sudden, when the personal computer was developed, right, and then as the internet was developed, there was this explosive radiation into that niche, right? I mean, the internet companies just sprung up every day, didn't they? Exploded into that niche. And that's what can happen in the biological world. If a niche, whatever that niche is, if it's empty, animals can move into that niche. And then what happens if the niche gets overcrowded? You can have mass extinctions in that niche. Did that happen to the internet? Sure. I mean, an awful lot of internet companies just collapsed, didn't they, because the competition was too great. But that's how radiation works, adaptive radiation works in the natural world. And then punctuated equilibrium, that's a sort of a fancy term. It just means that evolution can happen faster, it can happen slowly. Okay, so this idea of equilibrium, that there's no evolution of a given trait for a long, long time, and then all of a sudden there's quick radiation of something, adaptation, quick evolution of something. And the people, Stephen Jay Gould and his colleagues that published on this in the 1970s, they believed that this punctuation, this sudden change in evolution, would happen in sudden geological time. So 50,000 years. They thought sudden was 50,000 years. So, right, so the dinosaurs maybe are cruising along for 200 million years, and then something happens rather suddenly. I will show you in a few minutes how evolution can happen a lot faster than 50,000 years. Okay, but anyway, those are lots of ways in which evolution can take place. And I hope that they make sense to us. So while we're on this topic of natural selection, why don't I say a couple words about Charles Darwin? Because it was one of the great, I think, one of the great thinkers of all time. He would have won the Nobel Prize if there was any such thing at the time. But born 1809, studied medicine, also studied divinity. Right, there were only a few things you could study in those days, right? Medicine, divinity, law, right? Philosophy, that was about it, I think. But he was invited to sail on the Beagle, right? The captain wanted a companion, so I think he went along as a companion, an educated, well-bred person, but also a person with a deep interest in nature. And he made observations, right? The Galapagos Island, for example, he noticed that there were different finches on different islands that had beaks that were slightly different shapes, and they ate slightly different foods. So he thought, wow, could that happen by natural means? Could those differences develop by natural means? Now, he grew up in agricultural area, and I think he understood that you can breed horses, right? You can breed cows or dogs. So he knew that this artificial breeding, artificial selection was possible. So why not have the possibility that this could happen in nature, too? Well, he came home from his five-year voyage and sat around for, 23 years thinking, all the time thinking. And he was writing letters to scientists in France and Germany, for example. It's fascinating to read those letters. They're all collected. You can read them online. But he communicated with people. He thought about things. And I think he only published The Origin of Species because he learned that someone else was about to publish on that topic. So he thought, I better hustle my book into print before I get scooped, right? So he wrote really a couple of books, died in 1882. But he really was just, a careful thinker, a careful observer, and he published his observations. But what happened? It just, he was just pilloried all over the world, and there's just any number of cartoons like this with people making fun of Charles Darwin, We're descended from the apes and all of that. But here's the last sentence in Charles Darwin's book. I just love this sentence. There is grandeur in this view of life, with its several powers, having been originally breathed by the Creator into a few forms, according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved. Now, isn't that just a wonderful sentence? He used the word evolve, the very last word of his book. He does not use the word evolution at all, and I think that word evolved he only uses once in his book, right, the very last word. Originally breathed by the Creator into a few forms, and from that, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved. So that's the beauty of Charles Darwin. So can we see evolution happening, right? When was the last time you had a shot of penicillin? So what happened with penicillin? It was used and it was abused, right? Probably if you had a little sore throat, a viral sore throat, you still got that shot of penicillin. And what happened? You killed off a vast number of bacteria, susceptible bacteria, right? The Staphylococcus, the Streptococcus, killed off most of them, but some of those bacteria could make an enzyme, right? an enzyme called, they're called penicillinase. So if the bacteria could make that enzyme, it could cleave the penicillin molecule and survive. Okay, so a few of these penicillin-resistant bacteria survived, and then they're the ones that go on reproducing until after a while penicillin doesn't work, right? And we know that this happens over and over again. We develop an antibiotic, and then after a while the bacteria develop resistance to that antibiotic, right? And so we worry about superbugs, don't we? But this is evolution, okay? This just simply is, right? This is bacteria that are changing and change, you know, almost before our eyes. In fact, you can go on YouTube and you can actually watch some time-lapse photography in which bacteria migrate across an auger plate and they come into contact with a drug and then slows their progress a whole lot, and then suddenly they learn how to deal with that drug and then they continue to reproduce. Okay, so it's these organisms like bacteria or viruses that reproduce so quickly. That's how you can actually observe evolution in the natural world. We ever think, and we see this in the media sometimes, where did the AIDS virus come from, right? Because when we were all kids, there was no such thing as AIDS, and then all of a sudden there was AIDS. Those yellow dots over there on the right are all different strains of the AIDS virus, right? There's not just one AIDS virus, but there's a lot of strains. These are all mutants, right? Different mutations of the virus. Same thing with Zika, by the way. You know, we read about Zika virus now in the news. There are different strains of Zika, and those strains behave differently. But where do they come from? Well, it turns out in the Congo, somebody froze some tissue back in 1959. I don't know anything about that, but some tissue was frozen. And so when you look at that tissue and analyze it, you find the AIDS virus in that frozen sample in 1959. So if you do the mathematics and kind of extrapolate backwards, it looks like 1930 is about when either an ancestor of AIDS virus or the first AIDS virus arose. Okay, 1930, and you know, presumably in the Congo or some part of Africa, and people think that the green monkey carried that virus for some time, and then finally either an infected green monkey bit the human, or maybe the human ate infected monkey meat, and somehow that's how the virus got from the monkeys into the human. Okay, and then of course this was a new niche for the AIDS virus, wasn't it? The human body was a new niche for the virus, and the virus has done pretty well for itself. Well, temperature in the environment can affect evolution. This, I think, is just a neat graph. You know, lizards, alligators, turtles, snapping turtles, crocodiles. So it's a general graph. They don't exactly name the species of these animals. But look in that upper left, you see if the temperature is 20 degrees centigrade, 100% of those lizards and alligators will be female. And out at 40 degrees, 0% will be female. So can you see how a change in the environment could cause a certain animal to just go extinct? Right in that area. If 100% are female or if 100% are male, there won't be reproduction. And so it varies for different animals. But you see how important temperature is, at least for this set of amphibians and reptiles. I'll give you another example. I've seen this bird around the village, right? There's some of these around the village, the junco, right? The dark-eyed junco. And we have them in our backyards. Can you see those white tail feathers? The outer white tail feathers, okay, and those the plumage gets a lot more vivid in the breeding season, and that includes those white tail feathers. They get brighter in the breeding season. So some scientists at UC San Diego studied the junco, and they knew that the junco lived mostly in the mountains, but over time some of these juncos moved down into the city. And they also knew that these tail feathers can be used in courting, or they can be used in disputes. There are actually some scientific studies published that the male can flare out the tail and really flash those tail feathers at other males. They noticed, though, and they captured juncos and they spread out the tail in a very prescribed way, and they photographed the tail. And they studied the intensity of white in those tails. And when they did that, they found that the city birds had, on average, 22% less white than the mountain birds. And what they believed was that the mountain birds are living in the forest, they're living in thickets. It's helpful for them to have brighter tail feathers than the ones in the city, which are really just out on people's yards, right? And so they captured some birds and they raised them and really concluded that this change in the amount of whiteness in those tail feathers is genetically controlled. So there wasn't just a pale mountain bird that came down to the city and reproduced, but rather these birds lost the whiteness over time. They didn't need it in the city, and so they lost that white. So this was a kind of a landmark paper showing that a change like in a trait, like the whiteness of tail feathers, could get incorporated into the genetic makeup of these birds all in 20 or 25 years. So can you see evolution happen? Can you measure it, quantitate it, document it? Yes. So here's Tasmania, right? There's this creature. I guess this is kind of a nasty carnivore. It's about the largest, right? The largest carnivore?
No.
Not the largest carnivore, but...
Well, the existing one now. There used to be the Tasmanian tiger.
Which is extinct, right?
Which they think is extinct, but there might be a few still remaining, recently thought.
Yeah. So this is called the Tasmanian devil, and it's got a thick neck, and it's got pretty big jaws. This is called the devil because he is a nasty creature, and they bite each other, right? And they just do, and the trouble is they spread a tumor, okay? And this tumor is called devil facial tumor disease. They spread this tumor, and for a while people thought they were spreading a virus, but they've never identified a virus in these animals. But they think this sort of works like transplantation, tissue transplantation. When you bite an animal, you actually transfer some of the cells, some of the tumor cells, to the other animal. Well, it's killed 80% of these animals in the last 20 years. Okay, so the mortality is great. They're worried that this Tasmanian devil would be an endangered species. But of course, scientists will ask, well, why did 20% survive? And so they've been studying the DNA of the survivors, comparing it with those that didn't survive. And it turns out, just in the last week or so, I think there's been a publication in which they found some differences in chromosomes in the survivors. Okay? But I think this is a terrific example of natural selection, right? Survival of the fittest. If you had this enhanced immunity to the tumor, then you survived. Most of the animals did not have that immunity, and so they died. Okay, but you observe all of this over 20 years or so. Well, you can observe other things too, and this is, you could say, the evolution of a trait. Okay, it's not evolution of human species exactly, but the evolution of a trait, and that trait is height. Right, so this is some studies from Swedish boys and girls, and they measured their height. So you've got three growth curves, 1883, 1938, 1968, right? And kids are getting bigger over time, right? We know that, don't we? And presumably better health care, better nutrition, and so on is the result of this. But you can see over time how a trait changes, right? And if you've ever been to places like Fort Ticonderoga, right, and in Vermont, right, and you know that the French soldiers were short at that time, I'm sure the British were too, the little slots where they fired their muskets, you know, are down in here. Right, the doors were lower, right? So clearly, these soldiers were shorter than they are now, and the military has always measured its recruits because they have to know how large to make the uniforms. So I think the Dutch have information like this going back 600 years. Okay, yeah. So we're getting bigger over time, aren't we? And if we continued getting bigger and bigger and bigger. A time might come when somebody studies our cemeteries and says, boy, those people in the 1700s were short, and these people in 2100 are tall. You know, are these two different species, right? You would ask yourself that. But we would know, nah, it's just the same species getting bigger and bigger. But in the fossil record, you've got something that's small and something that's large. Now you have to ask yourself, are we talking about males and females, or is this normal variation in a group, right? So this would be a kind of question the evolutionary people would be thinking. So I made this point, but lots and lots of different disciplines are necessary to study evolution, okay? Lots of disciplines. So if you go off to Africa, you know, to search for fossils, you will have a geologist on your team, right? Because you have to know where these specimens are found, right? And I'll show you diagrams here in just a few minutes of how some of these areas, like Olduvai Gorge and so on, those areas have been mapped by geologists, right? You can see the strata, you know, all the different layers of rock, and you can identify those, and you can ascertain dates for those rocks. And so the paleontologist knows that if they excavate and find a specimen, they want to know exactly where did this occur in geologic time. Okay, in genetics, I'll have a couple of slides that talk about genetics, because the whole world of genetics is just exploding, you know, day by day. So lots of different disciplines, right? So the evolutionary biologist is not just some crackpot person, but it's someone who, if they make a discovery, that discovery has to be supported by lots and lots of basic science. Huh? So here's the geologist at work, right? And we know about plate tectonics, right? The Earth's crust is composed of plates. If those plates move a little bit, why? They cause earthquakes, right? But people noticed they mapped the western coast of Africa, and they mapped the eastern coast of South America, and whoa, you know, they're awfully similar, aren't they? They're very similar. Why on earth should that be? And after we learned about plate tectonics and the fact that the Earth's crust actually moves, you realize that some of these continents over millions and millions of years can be separated from other continents. So this is a pretty good explanation for why we have monkeys in Africa, we have monkeys in South America and Central America, don't we? And those monkeys are very, very similar, but they're not identical. Okay, so we talk about old world monkeys and new world monkeys, okay, and so on and so on. And this, of course, happened millions and millions of years ago. So I mentioned dating a little bit. You know, we want to date fossils when we find them, okay? And there are different ways of dating them. We've all heard about carbon-14, haven't we? But carbon-14 is only good, well, with carbon. It's only going to work with carbon, and only for back to maybe 50 or 60,000 years. So the archaeologist can use carbon-14 dating. Paleontologists cannot. If you're dealing with bones that are, you know, 3 million years old, why, carbon-14 dating won't work. But there are other techniques that will work, and so there's potassium-argon decay, right? And these are isotopes that change over time. Half-life of that decay is 1.3 billion years, so that's a technique that you would use for really, really old specimens. I just heard something in just the last few weeks, something called thermoluminescence, and I had never heard of thermoluminescence, so I looked it up. And it turns out, we know that the Earth is constantly bombarded by radiation, right? What, gamma rays and X-rays, lots of rays are bombarding the Earth. Things like sand on the ocean beaches and rocks, so certain rocks, can absorb that radiation, and you can measure it. You take this sand, for example, put it in an oven, heat it up, and then, I don't know, you've got dials and transistors and stuff, right? And somehow you measure the radiation that's emitted from these samples, and you can use that to date specimens. It's very cheap. This technique is something like $300. I read $300 to $700. You can have a sample tested by thermoluminescence. Oh, goodness, right? That's awfully cheap to get an answer, and it's pretty accurate. So these dating techniques are constantly being developed, and they're more and more accurate. Because, see, some of this stuff, like that decay, 1.3 billion years, that might actually be 1.3 billion years plus or minus 5 million years or something, right? There's a standard deviation there. So you these are just approximations. Paleobotany, this idea that, right, or relative dating, that if you find a fossil monkey and then you find a fossil tree, right, and then what you know about fossil trees and what you know about fossil monkeys, it should kind of match up, right? So the evolution of trees, the evolution of animals, all of that should kind of match up. I'll show you examples of comparative morphology where we're just studying the anatomy of different creatures. And paleomagnetism, my next slide, I think, gets at that. And stratigraphy, of course, this idea that we study levels of geologic specimens. You know, you could excavate the town dump, couldn't you? And you know that 1950 is on top of 1940, which is on top of 1930, 1920. So really, that's what you're doing, is just looking through the different layers in the earth crust. And see, here's an example. There's a fish that dies and lays on the ocean floor or a pond or whatever. It gets covered with some sediment, and then over time that sediment, maybe it shifts a little bit. And then after a while, that specimen, the lower right there, the pond or the ocean or whatever dries up. The soil erodes, and there's a little bit of the specimen sticking out. Okay, and so the people who look for human fossils in Africa, for example, that's what they do. After the rainy season, they just go walking, you know, through Olduvai Gorge or wherever. They just go walking, and they're just looking on the ground, right? They're not out there with shovels and pickaxes just willy-nilly digging in the dirt, because that's not productive. But they go for a walk after the rainy season. They see what's sticking up out of the earth. And that's how Louis Leakey made his, you know, career, was just looking at, you know, things that are eroding out of the earth. So that's stratigraphy, this idea of working down through layers. And again, the geologist will want to understand what all those layers are. And here's paleomagnetism, or magnetostratigraphy. Probably nobody ever heard of this, right? But this is wild. Over millions and millions of years, the polarity of the Earth changes. And so a simple way to describe that is, now our compasses point north, but in eras of reversed polarity, our compass would point south. And so iron-bearing rocks can have particles in them that are actually oriented but different ways. And so you can actually measure that, and then you can graph it. And partly I just show this graph to show how complicated and how sophisticated some of these studies are. And there are, on the left there, you know, those are all different geological levels. And then there in the middle, they've mapped the polarity. They talk about normal polarity, reversed polarity, or areas where the polarity is not known. And then they assign dates to all of that. Okay, and those are areas in South Africa. Okay, so that's pretty sophisticated science, isn't it? And, you know, these sites are mapped, right? This is, Zhukutian is a well-known site in China. So there, upper left, there's its relationship to Beijing. See, and then an artist sketched the valley just so you'd have a feel for this. And then the caves, these are caves in Zhukutian. They're mapped out. And then within the cave, why, you have grids, right? And so archaeologists or paleontologists, when they're excavating an area, they have grids. And these grids are laid out with string on the ground. And then you go down inch by inch through the grid, and you identify every single thing that you find in those grids, and you photograph it and all that, and then and every specimen is labeled, right, and given a number. And so over time you learn what's going on in this area. So just showing you that as an example, right? So I mentioned relative dating and paleobotany, but here's a sketch that describes the evolution of horses. Right, for the last 55 million years, evolution of different species of horses, and showing how their diet has changed. Okay, so you would maybe find a fossil horse, and then maybe you'd find some fossil seeds, right, or fossil bark or something next to this horse, or in the same strata, the same level as that horse, right? And you, again, it's a way of relative dating of these creatures. Other thing you can do is study the teeth of these fossils and study the surface of the teeth with a microscope and make some guesses as to what the creature was eating. We'll get at that in a minute. So see, when I was talking about small specimens and big specimens, see how confusing that can be? You find some specimens that's 10 million years old, right? Here's a small one, here's a big one. What's going on, right? And these are both cats, aren't they? But gee whiz. They're different, but they're classified as cat because they have identical anatomy. It's just one is a whole lot bigger than the other. So here's a dinosaur, a small dinosaur called Psittacosaurus, and this was published just in, I think, the last couple of years. But lo and behold, there's some soft tissue still attached to that skeleton. You know, you think of skeletons just being dried bones, right, out there in the ground. This one has soft tissue attached to it. It's got skin, it's got skeletal muscle. They even identified the stomach, and they identified stomach contents. Okay, actually, with a microscope, this is all petrified, right, or if that's the word, but you could identify what this creature was eating. Okay, so in there the artist made a guess as to what this creature might look like. It's called Psittacosaurus because I guess it's sort of parrot-like. And this is 100 million years old, discovered in China, and it's got still had soft tissues attached to it. Right now, when I say soft tissues, I mean, I'm sure they're rock hard, right, at this point. It's petrified skeletal muscle. But still, it's there, and you can identify. You know, there's been this long debate for years. Did the dinosaurs have scales? Did they have skin? Did they have feathers? Right? So you can actually understand some of that if the specimen happens to be preserved. So these are very important specimens. So in evolutionary science, we talk about primitive traits and derived traits. Okay, so this is just a primitive forelimb, right, an arm or whatever. But a whale would have a fore flipper that would look like this, right? The mammals all have this. There's the humerus, the radius, the ulna, carpal bones, metacarpal bones, phalanges, right? And there are five digits, so that's called a pentadactylous condition. It's a primitive condition. You find it in lots and lots of fossil specimens. Okay, but then over time, what you study and what you look for is, would a trait change? Okay, and this particular trait in generalized terms does not change, right? This condition of five digits has been around with us for a long time. So there's the hand of a gorilla, right? That's the right hand of a baby gorilla. And sadly, this gorilla had died, and I was able to participate in the autopsy of this gorilla. So that's my hand holding this gorilla's hand. And the gorilla's hand is different than ours, isn't it? There's a radiograph of the gorilla's hand, but still, it looks an awful lot like a human hand, doesn't it? It would be fun, I suppose, to, you know, play a trick on some radiologists, right, and show them that x-ray and see what they have to say about it. It would not be fair, but it would be a lot of fun to do that, wouldn't it? I do that with the dental students. I've got an x-ray of a monkey with a cleft palate, and I show it to the dental students and just harass them a little bit. You know, because they look at it and they're quizzical, right, and they're saying, it doesn't quite compute. I can't quite figure it out. But and then, of course, I tell them what it is. But you know, the x-ray of a monkey's skull looks an awful lot like a human skull. It just does. So these are our shared characters, right? We have a hand. The gorilla has a hand. They're different, but they're also remarkably similar. So here's an example of a fossil skull that we might find, and I think this is one is found by Lewis Leakey, and he was very famous for this. He really was walking along through Olduvai Gorge, and here was part of this skull just sticking up out of the ground. Lewis Leakey, I guess, was a good fundraiser, and his wife Mary was the one who stayed behind and did a lot of the excavations. So she was very well known in her own right, and probably made more discoveries than Lewis did. But this was called Australopithecus, which means southern man, right? Australia is where that south terminology comes from. Australopithecus boisei. And this was a very stout creature, very, very robust creature. So 1.5 million years old. But talking about these shared characters or derived characters, see how high the cheekbones are? Right, here's part of the maxilla right there. And these are called pillars, maxillary pillars there and there. And you see they're pretty stout, aren't they? So that's not a human skull, right? We might have had one of our bosses might have looked like that once upon a time, but I don't know. See the supraorbital ridges or the brow ridges there, very prominent, aren't they? This part of the palate looks pretty stout, right? So probably that individual had real big teeth and was a serious chewer. We also know it's a serious chewer because see the upper right of that skull? See that thing? That's called a sagittal crest, right? If we feel the top of our skulls, it's just rounded off, right? It's just rounded. But if you feel your dog's skull, your dog has a sagittal crest. The skull is not rounded across the top of a dog's skull. Instead, it has these big indentations on both sides, and that's where the masseter muscles insert, right? So if you see a sagittal crest, you know that this is an animal that has enormous teeth, enormous muscles for chewing, okay? You look at the orang today, gorilla, the chimp, a bunch of the monkeys, they have a sagittal crest, and so does the dog. Okay, so we can learn about the dietary habits of that individual just by studying a skull, even though it's 1.5 million years old. And that black stuff in those orbits is just dirt, kind of petrified dirt. They call it matrix, and it hasn't been chipped away. So that's Australopithecus. And look at how things have changed over time. This is, I say changed over time, I shouldn't say that, because see, this is Homo habilis, but it's 1.8 million years old. Okay, we said this guy is estimated to be 1.5 million years old, a precursor of humans, if you will, or a fossil ape, if you will, but 1.8 million years old, Homo habilis. And so this was a genus Homo, right? So a relative of ours who was starting to use tools, and so he was called handyman or Homo habilis. Also found in East Africa. But look at the differences. The cheekbones are much smaller, aren't they? And these maxillary pillars, I think, are smaller. We see some of the teeth, and they look like those teeth are smaller. There's no sagittal crest, right? The skull is rounded over the top. So this specimen is different enough from the last one that it was assigned a different genus, right, and a different species named both. But you see that skull has been fractured, hasn't it? And I think if you lay in the ground for a million years, right, and then an elephant walks over your grave or something, right, you can have a splintered skull. And that skull has been reconstructed. And people argue about that. You know, they'll say, well, you know, you when you glued this back together, you put that piece in upside down, you know. And people debate that a whole lot. And you go to the anthropology meetings, and it's just like the shootout at the OK Corral. I mean, these people debate each other mightily. And that's how science works. So look at this. Here's a paper just from 2009 comparing the accuracy of three techniques used for estimating missing landmarks when reconstructing fossil crania. Okay, and so you see, I make this point that science is self-correcting, right? Scientists are constantly trying to do better, trying to learn more and more about their craft. So here are some scientists that compared three different techniques to see what's the most accurate way of reconstructing the crania. See, and this is, right, this is what I mean by reconstructing, right, when you put those pieces back together. And you could, depending on how you put them back together, you could probably introduce some artifact into the specimen, couldn't you? So science works like that. Here's another example. We know this specimen, Lucy. Have we heard of Lucy? Right, Lucy was discovered by Donald Johansson and his crew, 1974. They were in the Hadar region, right, the Afar Triangle, it's called, in Ethiopia. You know why it's called Lucy? Because they went back to their tent. They found this skeleton, and they were wildly excited about this skeleton. When they went back to the tent, they were playing that Beatles song, Lucy in the Sky. That song was popular then, and so they named this specimen Lucy. Believed that Lucy was a fully mature female. The third molars are erupted. There's not much to that skull up there. See, there's just a few pieces and a little bit of the lower jaw, the mandible. Okay, so there's an awful lot missing from this specimen, but still they were thrilled because I think they've got 40% of a skeleton. And you can learn an awful lot. I'll show you some slides in a minute. You can learn an awful lot if you have a whole bone or a half of a bone. But we talked about that last slide where people compare different techniques for studying skulls and for reproducing them. Some orthopedic surgeons x-rayed this skull and said they found compression fractures in those long bones and also spine and pelvis. They found a lot of compression fractures. And they said Lucy fell out of a tree. And she died, you know, with compression fractures like this. And so this would be important because you're asking the question, was this a tree dweller, right, an arboreal creature, or did these live on the ground? So if she fell out of a tree, well, that would be important to know, wouldn't it? But a bunch of the people who have studied Australopithecus over the years said, no, they're not compression fractures. We call it geologic distortion. These bones have been laying in the ground for, you know, 3.2 million years old, and you'd expect them to have cracks in them, right? So there's been, just in the last couple of years, there's been debate over this, a lot of debate between orthopedic surgeons. They're saying, hey, we know fractures, right? And you've got these paleontologists saying, yeah, well, we know a whole lot about old bones, right? So this is the way science progresses. And that's what Lucy or one of those Australopithecines would look like. It's just an artist's idea, isn't it, based on what we know of that skeleton. And lots of specimens of this species have been found. Okay, so Lucy's is unique, but lots and lots of other specimens have been found as well. Okay, so this is just an example of how this is Homo erectus now, a more recent example of a fossil human. Lots of specimens have been found, right? Olduvai Gorge in Africa, right? Chicoutien is China, right? Terneel is Europe, right? And this mandible from Heidelberg. So we talk about specimens being rare, but it is probably true that there are thousands of specimens of a given species, right? So Neanderthals, for example, there are thousands and thousands of specimens. Okay, so a lot is known about that. So you see that Heidelberg mandible. I think I'll show you a picture of that in a minute. But the bones are important. Of course, they're important. If you measure the length of the femur, for example, that there are then mathematical equations to determine how tall the individual was. Right? And we can do this for sure for living humans because that's all been worked out. But you get pretty good estimates for the fossil specimens too. But also, you see, these are just photographs from a modern-day anatomy book, and we know that different muscles insert onto bones in different areas. See, there's gluteus minimus up there. See that tuberosity, that upper left protuberance. If you have a bump on a bone, depending on the size of that bump, you can estimate how large the muscle was that inserts onto that bone. Okay, that's called the greater trochanter, isn't it? The part of the head of the femur there. Greater trochanter, right? You can feel that in your hip. And so if you study fossil bones, study them very carefully, you identify all the lumps and bumps on the bone, you can estimate the size of the muscle that inserted onto that lump. And so you can say, well, this animal was good at running, right? Or this animal was good at swinging from the trees. So you don't have the skeletal muscle, but you do have the bump on the bone. And you can do the same thing with teeth. Here's a chimpanzee upper jaw there on the left, and in the middle is that Australopithecine. That would be the same species as Lucy, and then a human over to the right. And you see, you ask, one of the questions you ask was, well, Australopithecus, the middle one, was it an ape or was it more human-like? You compare those dental arcades, and you see it really looks more like an ape, doesn't it? The molars and the premolars are parallel. In monkeys and apes, they're absolutely parallel. And in the human, of course, we have that parabolic arch, right? Right. We know that. You've probably seen your own dental impression, right? And it's an arch. And the teeth are smaller. So over evolutionary time, the teeth have gotten smaller. The arch has gotten broader. The canines, you see in the chimp, see how those canines are short? They're called peg-like canines or conical canines. The monkeys have long, long canines, right? You've seen pictures of baboons, right? National Geographic always has pictures of baboons with these ugly, long, vicious canines. The apes don't have that. The apes have the shorter canines. And it turns out that as the canines get smaller and smaller and smaller, the animals get more monogamous. Okay, so I think the great apes are monogamous. They have got much smaller canines. Anyway, you can learn a lot by the shape of the arch and also the shape of the teeth, the size of the teeth. And then you can, with the microscope, you can look at the surface of the teeth and take some guesses as to what the animal was eating. So here's that mandible that I think was in that earlier diagram. And it's a pretty big mandible. Homo erectus was a kind of a bulky creature. And you see the body of that mandible is pretty big. But you see how those teeth are all flattened? Teeth are all flat, aren't they? And we know that our teeth are not perfectly flat, are they? Our molars have the little occlusal surfaces, the cusp and all that. So this individual was eating whatever it was eating, it was coated with a little dust, okay, a little bit of grit, a little silt. Horses, elephants, any animal that eats grass for its lifetime is also chewing on a little bit of dirt, right, that's on the grass. They wear their teeth down, okay, and so that's exactly what's happened with this Homo erectus. Okay, so we can, and you can actually see gouges in those occlusal surfaces, and you say, oh yeah, there's that was caused by sand. Okay. That one mandible has been published at least 8 times. Okay, that one mandible has been studied in 1908, 1990. I don't know, maybe it's probably been published again, I don't know, but these specimens are very, very valuable, and they're worked up again and again and again. And these people probably, I don't know, they probably argue with each other over, you know, what the interpretations are. This one I read about very recently, and this just blew me away. So we can study teeth. You can look at them with a microscope and say, yeah, we think this animal was eating such and such. Some of these Neanderthal skulls, they have plaque, right? I mean, we have plaque on our teeth, don't we? The Neanderthal had plaque. You can get DNA out of that plaque, and you can identify what the animal was eating. Mm. All right, some of these, there were 5 specimens, Belgium and Spain. Some were eating meat, some were eating vegetables. One of these fossil jaws had an abscess, and they found enteric pathogens, right? The E. coli or Enterococcus, some bacteria that comes from your GI tract, they found in this dental abscess. So they said, this one guy must have had diarrhea. And on average, these fossils were 48,000 years old. And yet you can look at the dental plaque and you get the DNA. And they found some poplar in some of this plaque. And they said, well, poplar, I guess, has a derivative of aspirin in it. So maybe these Neanderthals were chewing poplar as a painkiller, right, 48,000 years ago. I just think that's wild. So we can study cranial capacity, right? The idea is that as your brain gets larger, you get smarter and you get more capable of doing things. Years ago, the only way you could measure cranial capacity would be to take something like millet seed, you know, a real tiny seed, and fill up, you'd have to have a skull in your hand, fill up the cranial vault with this seed and then measure the amount of seed. And so on average, chimps have like 393 cubic CC's. Australopithecus has a larger brain, Homo erectus a larger brain yet. So it was pretty primitive to just fill up a skull with millet seed and measure that. That was really kind of primitive. And the idea was that over time, brains have gotten larger and we've developed our intellectual capabilities with a larger brain. All right. Well, then this guy comes along. This is just, well, 2004, I guess, so early in the 2000s, people discovered fossil skulls on this island of Flores in Indonesia. So there's, and they thought it was a human, but not Homo sapiens, so they named it Homo floresiensis, and that's that upper skull, and then there's just a normal skull from Homo sapiens down below. But the skull was small, so, gee, what are you going to do with a small skull, right? And as I said, the size can be just confusing when you're looking at fossils. That was a small skull, so they say, well, was it normal or was it microcephalic, right? We know Zika virus causes microcephaly, doesn't it? You could imagine thousands of years ago there could have been a virus causing microcephaly on the island of Flores. You don't know. But then the skull was studied. And I want to show you this because this is a CT scan of one of those skulls. And so now you want to calculate cranial capacity. You don't need millet seed. And for example, that skull is probably full of petrified dirt anyway, so you couldn't do that. But you can do a CT scan, a 3D reconstruction of a CT scan, and then just tell the computer, okay, fill up that space with that pink shadowed stuff, we're going to call that brain. Fill up that space with brain tissue. And we know that the inside of the skull should match the outside of the brain, right? That's we know that for sure, that the skull and the brain match perfectly. So if you understand the anatomy of the skull, you should also understand the external anatomy of the brain. And then that lower right is just a virtual brain, and they made it blue instead of pink. But you see, that's all done by the computer. But we know it's accurate because our craniofacial surgeons, right, our plastic surgeons do this all the time. Probably at Children's Hospital in Seattle, every day they're doing 3D reconstructions of skulls. And the neurosurgeon, for example, or the plastic surgeon wants to know that information before they operate, right? So it's tremendous technology. And it can help the paleontologist understand the brain. And this is Dean Falk, a woman who works in Great Britain, and she's one of the world's experts on, I don't know even what you call it, neuropaleontology, right? She specializes in studying old brains, or at least surmising what old brains might have looked like. And so you've got, you know, frontal pole and the temporal pole, occipital pole. So you can make some educated guesses as to what the mental status of that that individual would have been. So this is Homo floresiensis, but we're still concerned about the size of that brain, right? So here's another anthropologist in London says, this study upsets one of our main concepts of human evolution, that brain size has to increase for humans to become clever. Okay, so that was the point I was making, right? The chimp, Australopithecus, Homo erectus, they're constantly, over evolutionary time, getting larger brains. Now all of a sudden, Homo floresiensis comes along. It's estimated to be 18,000 years old, and it's got a small brain. So what on earth is going on here? You see how discovery of a specimen can really throw a cog in the gears, right? Is that the word? Throw a cog in the gears? Throw a monkey wrench in the, you know, you throw something into something else. Well, so that was one individual, but the excavations have continued there, and they've now found 9 individuals, and on average, they're 3.5 feet tall. Okay, and they nicknamed it the Hobbit. But so you see, it turns out this is not an abnormal microcephalic individual, but instead they're pygmies, right? There was this pygmy race, if you will, living on this island until about 12,000 years ago. These 9 individuals, I think, are probably dated, you know, from 18,000 to 12,000 years or so. And they don't know why they went extinct, but they said, well, maybe a volcanic eruption killed them all, or maybe Homo sapiens showed up and killed them all, right? They don't know. But they're guessing that Homo erectus migrated, you know, out of Africa across southern Asia to Indonesia, and then might have evolved into Homo floresiensis with some kind of dwarfing condition happened, and that's not understood. Okay. So that's how a new specimen can be discovered. You can develop a theory about, you know, microcephaly or whatever, then hopefully you get other specimens and learn more and more and more about these creatures. So what do we do with all these techniques? Right? A lot of techniques. They help us to sketch out the divergence of traits. So this trait could be anything, right? It could be the presence of that sagittal crest, the size of the maxillary pillars, right? The size of the third molar, right? Because people specialize in a lot of stuff, so the trait could be whatever you choose to study. And then over time, the trait diverges, right? And this would be called microevolution. It would just be one trait that changes over time. But if enough time goes by and those traits diverge enough, this would be how a new species arises, which is then called macroevolution. So that's just the evolution of one trait. It's just a schematic, right? So I don't know. I thought I would take a shot, right, and give you an example. Yeah. But a lot of things diverge over time, don't they? And Christianity split off from Judaism, then Islam split off, right? And so you could put some years onto that y-axis, and then a fight would ensue, right? People would argue about exactly what happened. So you see, anthropologists are arguing all the time about how different traits diverge. But people publish these kinds of graphs as a way of helping understand how a given trait can evolve. So you see, here's now a fancier graph that shows that kind of evolution. And you see, here's the idea that about 30 million years ago, we had some kind of an ancestor mammal, and then the traits diverged enough so that they developed into monkeys and apes. Okay, so here are the old world monkeys down on this lower part of the graph, and then the apes up above, and then there's the lesser apes, right, the gibbons, and then the greater apes. And then finally, humans split off from some of those apes about 7 million years ago. So we know that Australopithecus is about 7 million years old, and no human fossils have been found older than that. Okay, so you can see how important it is to have dates, isn't it? And so these dating techniques are just awfully important. And hopefully you have lots of specimens so that you don't want to build your theory based on just one little specimen, right? And just another example of how the classification goes, right? Some of this we learned in high school, and then it gets more and more fancy as the years go by. But there are the major groups of primates anyway. Okay, so we're talking a little bit about primates. Anything wrong with that picture? It's just an ad from a medical journal, but of course it's a chimp, right? That's a chimpanzee. So a chimp is an ape, it's not a monkey, right? So we've got New World monkeys, Old World monkeys, greater apes, lesser apes. And so that's cute, but it's also scientifically wrong, isn't it? Yeah. So here's just an artist's idea of how apes and Australopithecines and humans might have, how their locomotion might have changed over time. If you know, I should say before I forget, you can use the same anatomy book to dissect a baboon, a chimpanzee, a human. You can use the same book because the bones, the muscles, they are the same. The differences, there's a couple of trifling differences. A muscle called a lumbrical that's between the digits that helps, I guess the ape can do this better than we can. There's a tiny slip of a muscle called sternalis. I mean, it's just ridiculous stuff that's so trivial that, you'd put it on a test just to harass your students, right? But it makes no difference. Same anatomy book, okay? So I should think, when you read scripture and it says God created man in his own image, say, well, maybe that's meant to be metaphorical, because then God also created the great ape and the old world monkey in the same image, right? So same anatomy, just different sizes, right? The chimpanzee walks into your office and applies for a job, you know that something's amiss. And so all of these different individuals that we've been talking about, you see that here are some pretty good dates. Australopithecus afarensis, that was Lucy, right? And Australopithecus robustus, that really was that Boisei, that big skull that we talked about. Okay, and there's the Neanderthals up there. But you see what is so fascinating, isn't it, is you see how they overlap. They overlap, and that's why dating is so important. And when people learned that these were overlapping, that just was like putting a firecracker in the anthropology textbook, because this is not linear evolution, right? This is not just one species sort of gradually or whatever developing into the next species, but they're developing side by side. And it looks like there were millions of years when some of the primitive Homo taxons were surviving with Australopithecus at the same time, right? So was there interbreeding or not, right? I don't know, but this is how really evolution is sort of like that Rorschach blot, right? You put a drop of ink on the soft paper and it just goes in lots of directions. Okay, and Homo sapiens, right? Pretty recent development. And you can do that with other traits as well. See, that's just color-coded to show small brain, small teeth, right, and all that. And you can understand how different species, different genera, really, had different abilities. I'll just say a couple of words about migration, but the early Australopithecines were found in South Africa. I don't know if you know about the Tong baby, right, but 1926 or something, a small skull was found down there in Tong, and it was a baby. I mean, they call it the Tong baby. I forget its exact age. A baby skull, I think, would not have survived, so maybe it was 4 years old or something. And then the the limestone caves, right? Sterkfontein, Schwarzkranz, those are limestone caves. And over time, the limestone leaches away, right, and it leaves a cave. And so very important specimens were found in these caves. Okay, Cubifora, Omo, right, Hadar, the East African specimens are pretty well known. And then up in Europe, those are all, primarily those are Neanderthal sites. Okay, and then Homo erectus way over there in China. So lots and lots of sites, and these are famous sites. See where it says Neander Valley up there at the top of the Neander Valley? In German, right, Neanderthal means just that, the Neander Valley. That's where that term comes from. What?
There's supposed to be something else happening here at 4 o'clock.
What? I thought I had till 4:15. Is that so?
It's just the image, the fire movie, but it's someplace else.
Oh, so we're okay? Okay. So lots of sites around the world. And so by dating those different sites, dating specimens that you find in those different sites, you develop this kind of scheme for how creatures would have moved out of Africa and migrated into other areas. And this is just absolutely fascinating because you see up there at the Bering Strait in Alaska and Siberia, maybe 30,000 years ago. Right, and at one time, there was a land bridge between Siberia and Alaska. So, and then the level of the ocean changed. So I think in the Bering Strait, the water's only about 200 feet deep. And if you go down 200 feet, I think they actually find either fossils or stone tools and things, I think, yeah. But this is a theoretical pattern, isn't it? It's going to depend on the dates that you assign to specimens in those different areas. Well, as I said, the genetics are allowing us to learn a tremendous amount. You know, over the years, mostly we did anatomy, right? You would find bones, you'd find skulls and so on out there in the ground. And so it was the anatomists that were studying these specimens. Now we can actually get DNA out of some of these old specimens. Okay, so there's just some chromosomes with some DNA on it, and you can actually extract some of that DNA, which is really, right, the genetic history of this animal. So we know that our DNA gets diluted over time, doesn't it? So your great-great-grandmother, your great-grandmother, and so on, 50% dilution of your genetic material with every generation. So this happens in all of the biological world. So you can do different calculations to estimate what genetic change would be through the generations. Okay, and so if you do that, that's just an example where people have mapped a certain gene. This is just this gene called MAPT, but they've actually mapped it around Europe, and you see how some incidences are pretty high there around Italy and Greece and so on. And then as people migrated and as these genes became diluted, why the prevalence of that gene would be much, much less. Okay, so that's just one gene that people have studied, but they've studied it in quite a bit of detail, haven't they? And you could probably study one gene and get some ideas of how people migrated, right? The linguists do the same thing, don't they? How does language change over time, right? And so you could do the same thing with language or with genetics here. And that's just one example of a gene, but it's a gene that's pretty well understood. So humans and chimps, you've heard this probably, right? But we share a tremendous amount of genetic identity, okay? So there's a protein called cytochrome C. We have the exact same protein sequence. And so if you say, well, how can we have the exact same protein as a chimp has? You do the mathematics and say the possibility that could happen by chance, right? That the chimp and the human could have this exact same protein sequence, 1 out of 10^93. So 10 with 93 zeros after it. That's the possibility that would happen out of chance. Okay. So then you say, well, if we are identical in some ways to the chimp, this must mean that we shared a common ancestor, right? The same way that last slide showed the great-grandmother, the grandmother, and so on. We must have shared a common ancestor at some point. So you can do that with the Neanderthals. You can actually get DNA from Neanderthals from bones that are 50,000, 100,000 years old, you can get the DNA and you can sequence it so you know the exact order of all the amino acids. We are 99.7% identical to Neanderthals, okay? We are 98.8% identical with chimps, okay? So the chimp, of course, has genes that cause it to grow in different dimensions than we do, right? But 98.8% identical to the chimp, 99.7% to Neanderthals, and we still have, apparently we have Neanderthal DNA in our own DNA makeup these days. Okay, this is very sophisticated work. They found some contamination and all that. So, but pretty fancy work, huh?
Yeah.
And so, you can then do these mathematical calculations and say, well, when did Neanderthals and humans separate? And those years vary by a whole lot, don't they? So those are estimates. But something like 500,000 years ago, maybe, is where Neanderthal and the common ancestor of Neanderthal and Homo sapiens split off. Okay. Yeah, so people don't exactly know why the Neanderthals became extinct, but you know, this idea of a volcanic winter, perhaps that a volcano erupted, right, put a cloud of ash over the earth that turned the earth into winter for a period of time. Right. Not at all clear about that, but you know, it's one of the major ideas. Oh, we'll conclude one other thing from this study. The fact that we have Neanderthal DNA in our own DNA makeup should conclude one other thing, that the man cave we have evolutionary significance, right, to needing to have a man cave. So these are the points that I hope I made today, right, that evolution really is a fact, right? Change happens in the biological world. It just does. We can observe it, we can study it. The exact mechanisms, I hope I showed you today, some of these changes, a creature becomes extinct or not extinct, we don't necessarily know why. We really don't know how Australopithecus, you know, did Australopithecus eventually evolve into Homo, or were they parallel evolutionary pathways? We don't know that sort of thing, but the more information we get and the more techniques we develop, why, the more we'll learn about this. But it's ongoing, right? We're new discoveries all the time. I don't think this needs to be threatening to our faith, right? This is just science doing what science does, making discoveries and interpretations, okay? So this has been called the truth about nature, the nature about truth. The rocks of ages, the ages of rocks, right? How to go to heaven. What did Galileo say? Science, religion says how to go to heaven. Science says how do the heavens go? Right, but this is the way science works and the way evolution works. I think that's okay. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
We'll talk some tomorrow morning about, you know, can humans alter evolution? What are some of the ethical consequences of evolution? So we'll do that tomorrow at 11 o'clock. So thank you.
Thank you.